Good afternoon. It is about 3:08 on Thursday, March 12th, and President Health and Social Services is Vice Chair Vasquez, Representative Stutes, Representative Tarr, Representative Talrico, Representative Wool, myself, Chair Seaton. Remind everybody about their cell phones and address their comments or questions through the chair. On our calendar for today is a presentation by the Division of Public Health on Healthy Alaskans 2020, followed by a discussion of home visits and nutrition, and that'll be about the first hour. And then we'll have a short presentation on facing foster care, and that'll be about a 15-minute segment. And then we will go into our second hearing on HB 40, which is e-cigarettes, and we will have a presentation by the bill sponsor, a couple of invited guests, and then we will have public testimony. It is not our intention to move the bill today, but we'll take public testimony, but we will have to quit probably about 5 minutes early, so 4:40 or 4:55 or so, because we are going back on the floor at 5 o'clock. And so that'll give everybody a chance to make it to the floor. Is there anything that anybody had? I did announce earlier today that we were going to have a Medicaid expansion and reform working group on Saturday, March 21st. That'll be 4 to 6 p.m. That'll be in here. It won't be a committee meeting. It's going to be a working group so we can sit around and piece things together, see if there is a way forward that the committee wants to take. And so that will be what that is, that working group, not a regular formalized committee meeting. So we have today Division of Public Health and Dr. Butler and Jill Lewis. Would you come forward? And we have the presentation here. And just so everyone knows, I have a meeting about 4:30, so I'm going to, at that time, pass the gavel to Representative Vasquez, the Vice Chair, and then we'll continue with that. And that should be receiving public testimony. And members, I know with the budget up today, there's some people are coming in and out, but one nice thing is we can review this testimony now because it's all recorded, and people can catch up at another time if they have to go to other meetings during the day. So thanks and for coming. Would you identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer in the Department of Health and Social Services and also Director of the Division of Public Health. With me is Jill Lewis on the keyboards. Jill is Deputy Director of the Division of Public Health. Today we'd like to serve a public health buffet of conversations, including a quick overview of Healthy Alaskans 2020. And we'd also like to respond to two topics requested by the committee, one on home visits and one on nutrition. Nutrition is a very big topic, and quite a bit of the work that the division and we do throughout healthcare is focused on obesity right now. But for the purpose of this presentation today, I thought it would be more interesting to drill down on two micronutrients, folic acid and the ever-popular vitamin D. So, starting with Healthy Alaskans 2020, I'd like to rewind to the pilot episode of department presentations to this committee when Commissioner Davidson and I described the department areas of primary focus for the coming year. And she outlined the first being access to health care, second, child welfare, third, developing tribal and federal partnerships, and fourth, improving the health status of Alaskans. And I spent some time going through seven areas of opportunity and then finished that by saying and implementing the Healthy Alaskans 2020 plan will be part of the means to that end. So I want to provide a little more detail of that today. I feel like after Tuesday I need to...
Oh, yes. Before you go further, I just want to recognize that Representative Foster has joined us. We have a full committee.
Before I go any further, after Tuesday's hearing, I felt like I need to distinguish Healthy Alaskans 2020 from Healthy Alaska Plan. I know the Alaska and Alaskans can get a little confusing at times, but we're all moving in the same direction in terms of healthier people and a healthier state. I do feel a little compelled, with all due respect to my partners in the department, that the term Healthy Alaskans was one that we were using even back in the Hickel administration. I have a copy here of Healthy Alaskans 2000. So it is something that has been around for a while. Next slide. Healthy Alaskans 2020, though, is quite distinct from Healthy Alaskans 2000 and Healthy Alaskans 2010 in a number of measures. And I think the first is that this is really a state-tribal partnership. The effort has been co-organized and co-led by the Division of Public Health and the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. This partnership's a natural since both organizations have statewide public health responsibilities and work with local health care providers throughout the state. The mission of the Division of Public Health, of course, is to protect and promote the health of Alaskans. The vision of ANTHC is that Alaska Native people are the healthiest people in the world. This creates a synergy. Next slide, please. For achieving the vision of healthy Alaskans in healthy communities. The work has been driven by a statewide voluntary advisory team composed of some 35 Alaskans from a variety of disciplines, including behavioral health, education, early childhood development, environmental health, criminal justice, as well as public health, health care, health insurance, and health policy. Together, these partners have defined a mission for Healthy Alaskans 2020 to provide a framework and to foster partnerships to optimize health for all Alaskans and their communities. The advisory team also defined guiding principles for how the effort would go forward, including using the best scientific research and data available, as well as tapping into local knowledge from our diverse cultures. Also building strong partnerships with mutual accountability, not only to funders, but to one another. Addressing health equity, which continues to be a struggle in our state. Some of us are healthier than others. And much of that is driven by socioeconomic status. So we recognize that up front. Another guiding principle was to strengthen communities and empower individuals to be able to take personal responsibility for their health. And finally, to improve the quality of life across the lifespan, not just longer lives, but healthier lives. The process started in the communities, both through online surveys open to all Alaskans and with town hall meetings in a number of our communities that were co-led by state and tribal leaders. This provided an opportunity to get input and to learn what Alaskans feel like are important health issues. The advisory team participated in this process and met with data team and other subject matter experts to be able to parse this out and ultimately work through the more than 70 concerns, I think, that were raised, and to focus on the areas where there's good data and where we believe we can really make a difference. The advisory team makes recommendations to the Healthy Alaskan Steering Team, which is made up of the commissioner, the chief medical officer in the Department of Health and Social Services, as well as the CEO and the senior director for community health at ANTHC. I should add also that an unofficial guiding principle was that we can't do everything. I think the another partner effort is the Healthy People 2020, which is the national federal effort, which has, I think, over 2,000 goals and is a book about this thick. For the record, that's about 3 inches. So we really wanted to be able to focus in on areas where we could make a difference. Next slide. So the advisory team defined 25 health priorities with specific data indicators, action plans, and targets to meet by the year 2020. There's a scorecard defining sort of where we're at in terms of our baseline in 2010, our goal for 2020, and the most recent data, which is oftentimes lags for a year or two, or in some cases even three, but it gives you a feel for kind of where we're going. It highlights where we've achieved goals already. There's actually six of them that we've met our 2020 goal, and areas where we're not moving in the right direction right now. And this scorecard is in the back of your packet, I believe. The six where we've achieved, I want to stress, though, doesn't mean that we can any way relax. Health is part of the biologic systems that we're all representing, and oftentimes these are systems with a lot of moving parts, and we recognize that if we are not vigilant, that we could actually lose ground on some of these measures. And I'll just use as an example youth smoking, for instance. We've made tremendous progress, and we don't want to lose those gains. It's important to note that these indicators don't cover everything we do in the Division of Public Health. This really was a statewide process that incorporated partners outside of government, and that a number of the measures are really outside of the scope of what we do in DPH. It makes an exciting group, though, because we really have worked together to be bureaucratic silo busters and to look at how each of the organizations that are involved and each of the sectors can best play their hand the best to move us all in the same direction. I should also point out that this doesn't necessarily address new and emerging issues. For instance, during the discussions, I don't recall that the possibility of marijuana legalization ever came up. So there are things that are very high on our radar screen that you won't see here. Next slide. This graph, I recognize, is very complicated. It's one reason why you have it as a handout also. The intention, though, is to demonstrate how the advisory team has grouped the indicators to address broad topics such as the outcomes of longer and better life, and into health factors including healthy behaviors, access to clinical care, social determinants of health, which are things like economic health of our communities, and the physical environment. Next slide. Another difference with Healthy Alaskans 2020 is we don't have a book. What we do have is a website. Our feeling was that oftentimes reports like this can be useful, but they oftentimes wind up on shelves, and they are not living documents. So you can track the progress of Healthy Alaskans 2020 at ha2020.alaska.gov, and you can find updates on the performance data as well as description of evidence-based strategies to achieve the targets, as well as list of actions undertaken, who are the key partners, as well as state and national resources. Next slide, please. The partners involved in this have already described how they've used this effort to help guide their strategic planning and to develop performance improvement plans that can guide what they do best. The ongoing process will also generate accessible data to quantify the problems and progress. Healthy Alaskans has provided a focal point for understanding community priorities, for selecting strategies to improve health, and for leading efforts among the partners, including the Alaska Wellness Coalition, the UAA Behavioral Health Alliance, Recover Alaska, the All Alaska Pediatric Partnership, and the Juno Suicide Prevention Coalition, as well as the work we do in the Department of Health and Social Services, as well as ANTHC, which, just having come from there, I can say that was part of our annual evaluations for a number of our leaders. So to summarize the work to date, Healthy Alaskans 2020 has identified health priorities, set targets, and selected strategies to achieve those targets. It's actually a whole lot of work that I feel I'm underrepresenting in only about 10 minutes, particularly the work that many of the partners did over this time. The current focus is to make identify lead partners so that we can be sure that all of our efforts are aligned and that we continue to work together. I'd be happy, I think I'd be best to stop at this time and take any questions you have on the process. We have some providers from the division waiting to speak on the other topics. But both Jill's been very intricately involved in Healthy Alaskans 2020 with the advisory council. So either one of us would be happy to take any questions you have.
Great. Questions? Let's start on slide four, which had health equity there. Can you define how you are dealing with the guiding principle of health equity and how that drives the process?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and I'll defer to Jill if she has anything to add, but I'll start by saying part of the process that went into identifying the 25 priorities were looking at areas where some parts of the population had better health than others, and in particular we focused on inequities between Alaska Native people and other Alaskans. So that's why, for example, you'll see suicide was an issue that we didn't back down from. A very difficult problem, and one that our tribal leaders are struggling with and making some progress with.
It's better health status. Is that what we're talking about, inequity, or is it better, or is it access to health care or health facilities? I was just trying to figure out. Equity sometimes gets to be an amorphous term for us to figure out how it drives a process.
Right. Well, if I could use an example, Mr. Chairman, of a health measure of life expectancy, for instance. The life expectancy for Alaska Native people is about 5 years shorter than for other Alaskans. So that would be an example of a health inequity. In terms of access to care, that could be an example of a health inequity. I think if we're talking about Native people or non-Native people, that may be less of an issue, but we're looking at areas where some of us enjoy better health than others.
And so would that be subpopulations such as Pacific Islanders in Anchorage as a subpopulation, if they were exhibiting less healthy outcomes, then we would concentrate on figuring out what those, what could be contributing to that and address that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, although I would add that we would be doing that in partnership with those communities. That's one thing that I want to really emphasize in the whole effort is it's been a process where we've really tried to get input from the communities so that it's an effort that's not being done to people but is being done by people.
And often probably identifying the data is to know, to demonstrate that you do have health inequities. I guess that would be a big part of this as well, wouldn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
If you think. On slide seven, can you explain a little more? Like, we have length of life up there, and then we have 1, 7, 14, 16, and how those relate, or each of the numbers to where we are, whether it's what alcohol and drug use is 15 but it doesn't have 14 alcohol induced deaths or any of the things on child abuse or any of those aren't included in that. I'm trying to figure out how that works.
So for the record, my name is Jill Lewis. I'm Deputy Director for the Division of Public Health. and I will try and address your questions, Mr. Chairman. The numbers do correlate to the 25 leading health indicators, and in some cases, those indicators are very directly related to a particular health behavior or social and economic factor. Like, for example, tobacco use, number 2 and 3, are very specific for increasing the percentage of high school students who have not smoked and increasing the percentage of adults who currently do not smoke. So just showing that alignment, in some cases it's very specific, and so those are shown mostly in the lower portion of this grid. And at the top, the ones that you see up there are ones that are more general across categories of health factors and really focus on their overall health outcome. For example, number 1 is the rate of cancer deaths in the state, and that has is directly related to the length of life rather than a specific one of the other health factors or policies and programs.
And can you explain to us how this would be used? I mean, are we looking at, I mean, on the far left is health outcomes, health factors, and policies and programs, and then those lead into those other two, and I'm just trying to figure out how the flow chart works. Or are we looking at the left-hand side and then trying to figure out, okay, what are health outcomes, length of life, and quality of life, and then that those 8 specific ones that are targeted to that? So how would you use this in the collaboration? I mean, would you look at quality of life and then you would be identifying those 4 things as target to address?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the portion on the left with the arrows pointing up indicate that, you know, it, in order to address the full spectrum of health to get the best possible outcomes, you have the policies and programs first that influence the health factors. Those health factors influence your health outcomes. So it is building. And the health factors are the portion in the middle that are listed out in groups, the 4 main groups being the behaviors, the clinical care, the social and economic factors, and the physical environment. And if you don't address all of that, you aren't going to be able to reach those health outcomes. If for example, we had no leading health indicators that dealt with social and economic factors, then that would be a definite gap. The purpose of showing it to you in this grid is really sort of to illustrate the full array and the full spectrum that these indicators cover, that they aren't just about one thing like tobacco use or income or access to care, that it does cover the full spectrum, and that's what's necessary in order to really achieve the goals.
Okay, so you're using this as the identifier for what action you should take to work to the left, whether it's alcohol or drug use or diet and exercise. So you'd go diet and exercise and you'd look at number 6, and that would be physical activity, adults and youth, and then just trying to figure out if this is a mechanism by which you're trying to drive action, or this just an explanation of the way you look at the 25 health priorities.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's actually more of a way just to look at the 25 health indicators across the spectrum rather than a way that we would actually approach or organize aligning the efforts.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else have any questions on the first portion? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Butler, you were at the presentation for the Healthcare Commission, and in that presentation there were a series of policy recommendations and, you know, sort of the what had been generated from the work done by that group. And so I'm just wondering, from this work and then the work done by that group, is there some integration of those efforts so we're you know, sort of, yeah, just kind of bringing those efforts together, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
Yes. Representative Tarr, through the chair, thank you for that question. Yes, in fact, we even had it in the slide, although in respect for the time frame, I skipped over it fairly quickly. But there was representation from the Healthcare Commission in the process. And while I did mention it during the lunch and learn, if you go through the annual reports from the Healthcare Commission, there's a number of times that there are references to Healthy Alaskans 2020, particularly as it relates to some of the goals of the Healthcare Commission for prevention.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead. Your presentation, and I think that we don't have other questions at this point.
Okay, thank you. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce Rebecca Morrissey, who is in our section of Women's, Children's, and Family Health in the Division of Public Health, who can give us an overview of home visiting in Alaska. Becky, are you there? And if she's not, I'm not going to be nearly as good at
her.
Okay, very good.
I'm here now.
Okay, please proceed and let us know when you need the slides to forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Rebecca, would you please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Through the chair. Again, my name is Rebecca Morrissey. I'm the unit manager for Perinatal Early Childhood Health Unit, and I coordinate the Maternal Infant Early Childhood Home Visiting Program for our state. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about home visiting in Alaska. And so this will be the first slide, please, with an emphasis on evidence-based home visiting programs. So why is home visiting important for families, and why has it been an important part of public health? Well, there's established evidence that home visits by nurse, social worker, or other early childhood educator can improve child and family outcomes. We know that the early childhood time period is also a critical time for brain development, and a child's home is a critical part of the learning environment. We also know that parents do need support, and they often say that kids don't come with instruction manuals. We use the term home visiting a lot, but that really just describes the where. What we're really talking about is a voluntary program to provide family support and parent education. Next slide, please. So there are 17 models of home visiting that have been designated nationally as evidence-based through demonstration and randomized controlled trials. I've included some of those on the slide, and the first three that I have listed here that are bolded are the evidence-based home visiting models found in Alaska. Please note there are differences between home visiting models and programs. They can vary on the type of professional providing services, the intensity and frequency of visits, and also programs have different goals, objectives, the types of services that are delivered during a visit, and also programs may have different eligibility for participants. Next slide, please. So today I'm going to talk about what our Division of Public Health is doing with home visiting, highlighting these three programs I have listed here, our Maternal Infant Early Childhood Home Visiting Program, Healthy Start, and lastly, Public Health Nursing. So I'd also like to mention there are other home visiting programs going on in Alaska that are not administered through our division. There's home visiting services occurring in different capacities at the Office of Children's Services, the Infant Learning Program, the military, tribal health, and many other nonprofit agencies. Next slide, please. So the Maternal Infant and Early Childhood Home Visiting Program, we commonly refer to it as MICVIE, is administered through our section of Women's, Children's, and Family Health. We have one local implementing agency, which is Providence In-Home Services, and that's located in Anchorage. We've been talking more about home visiting in the past couple of years, but home visiting has been going on in Alaska for a long time in various capacities. Nationally, there's been an increased emphasis in recent years to implement evidence-based home visiting services to at-risk families and communities. In 2010, our section was a recipient of federal funding to implement an evidence-based model in an at-risk community in our state. And the emphasis on programs to be evidence-based has been an important change to the field and the profession of this work. After a statewide needs assessment was completed, Nurse Family Partnership was selected as the evidence-based model for the Alaska program. Next slide, please. So these, what I have listed here are the overarching goals of the McVie program, and they are to improve health outcomes, improve socioeconomic status, school readiness, decrease intimate partner violence and child maltreatment, and also improve parenting skills. States are required to report on a benchmark plan that has performance measures related to the six goals I have listed here. For example, we're looking at such measures as tobacco use, prenatal care, employment, breastfeeding, educational attainment, among many others. Next slide, please. As I mentioned before, Nurse Family Partnership was a model selected for our program, and it was selected as it best targeted the outcomes that public health wanted to improve in Alaska. It's an evidence-based model that is grounded in over 37 years of randomized controlled trials. Many studies involved comparing the maternal, child health, and child developmental outcomes with groups of similar mothers who did not participate in the Nurse Family Partnership program. Next slide, please. These are some of the outcomes that were identified in those randomized controlled trials, and you can see that there were improvements in such things as preterm delivery, child abuse neglect, school readiness, maternal employment status, and also decreases in criminal activity. Next slide, please. So being an evidence-based program, there's certain criteria and guidelines that are available. This program is administered by registered nurses in the home. And nurse home visitors are utilized in this model as they are perceived as trusting and competent professionals. Nurses have a set of visit-to-visit guidelines, or a curriculum, you could say, that guide the content of the visits throughout the program. However, the model does allow the client to also guide visit content and allows the nurse to use judgment when picking visit priorities or topics for that day. Women in this program must be enrolled by the 28th week of pregnancy and be a first-time mom. This allows for early education on having a healthy pregnancy. In the NFP program at Providence, clients must also be low income, and that's defined by Medicaid or risk eligibility. So visits begin prenatally and end when the child reaches age 2. Next slide, please. So the Nurse Family Partnership model includes all the health promotion content and screenings that are listed here in addition to many others. In regards to nutrition, the nurses cover with clients such things as what foods to avoid during pregnancy, portion sizes, you know, types of healthy foods needed in pregnancy, eating healthy on a tight budget, and taking multivitamins with folic acid, including the recommendation to take 0.4 to 0.8 milligrams of folic acid daily. An important part of this program is the relationship that occurs between the nurse and the client. The nurse serves as a model for healthy behaviors and believes in that client's success. Nurse home visitors also take a positive approach with clients to build on that client's strengths. So along with the important health education, promotion, and screenings provided by the home visitor, there's also discussion on life planning, and that includes such things as plans for work and also plans for further education. There's specific and measurable outcomes that are intended to change the life course trajectory for the woman and her family. Next slide, please. So what makes this program evidence-based? Well, a critical piece of implementing an evidence-based program is to maintain fidelity to the model, meaning that you're implementing the model in the way it was designed for replication. And we know that model fidelity is important to achieving the desired program outcomes. Following these elements allows you to best achieve the desired outcomes that were demonstrated in the original trials. In our Alaska program, monitoring fidelity models is an important part of our continuous quality improvement activities. Running data reports on these elements on a monthly basis allows both public health and the nurse home visitors to understand where things are going well and where there may be opportunities for improvement. And lastly, the content of the visits is consistent and based on prevention science. Next slide, please. So because of the randomized control trials and the extensive research on the replication of this program, Nurse Family Partnership has been able to demonstrate a return on investment. The RAND Corporation notes that for every dollar a community invests in NFP, they can see up to $5.70 in return. The trials noted increases in family education and employment status, along with savings related to governmental costs such as Medicaid and food stamps. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned previously, Alaska has a benchmark plan for evaluating if the program is meeting its purposes and goals. We have some preliminary outcomes on the mothers and children that have been seen in the first 21 months of the program. And in the small time frame, there's been demonstrated improvement in breastfeeding, prenatal care, which is a Health for Alaskans 2020 priority, tobacco use, and some others you see here. So by September 30th of last year, there were 100 women enrolled in the program, and that is the capacity of the program. Of the 7 mothers in the program whose child had reached 1 year of age by that time, 5 of the 7 had improved their employment status, and all 7 had improved their educational attainment level since enrollment. Our numbers and results still are small and in a rather short time frame, whereas Nurse Family Partnership has been following their families over the course of many years. Next slide, please. I also wanted to highlight another program within our division, and that's Healthy Start. Healthy Start is a case management program, and it's operated out of the Norton Sound Health Corporation, serving known in the surrounding 15 villages. It's not a home visiting program per se, but rather a case management program that includes home visits as a component. It also serves families from pregnancy until the child is age 2. The main goal of Healthy Start is to decrease infant mortality. And there's also a strong community focus in this program, along with a strong emphasis on linking clients with behavioral health services. Next slide, please. And lastly, public health nursing. It should be mentioned that while public health nursing doesn't have a formal home visiting program per se or use an evidence-based model, they do provide home visiting services in our state using evidence-based practice guidelines. These visits are done on a case-by-case, episodic basis, depending on the community and the number of resources that are available. And the target is really those families that are high risk, which I have listed here. So public health nurses monitor body mass index by measuring height and weight and provide counseling on having a healthy lifestyle. And they also provide important screenings related to immunizations, alcohol, and domestic violence. Next slide, please. So the goal really is not to provide long-term case management services in public health nursing, but rather for the nurse to link these at-risk families with needed referrals and facilitate that initiation of case management. And these services are not intended to duplicate any other home visiting services or models that may be provided in that community, but really act as a safety net for those at-risk families. Thank you.
Thank you, and I guess the Providence In-Home, so there's one program in the state, and that served about 100 pregnant women, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. There are 100 families. At the end of February, there were 105 families enrolled in the program. Each nurse has a caseload of 25 families with a supervisor who carries a small caseload of clients.
Okay. I guess, is there a plan to, with approximately 11,000 births and probably half of those are singleton first-term births, is there a 100 is a very small number compared to that, and also only being located in Anchorage, is this a pilot project to determine whether there's useful success at the cost or exactly trying to figure out what? I know that public health nurses aren't available for out-of-home visits almost exclusively, at least on the Kenai Peninsula. So this is non-public health nurses in a private setting. And how was that funded again?
Sure. So the funding comes from the federal government through the Health Resources Services Administration. And our state received the minimum amount of formula funding. So that is why we have one program in one community. We did apply for competitive expansion funding that was made available to expand the current program, and that is going to allow the addition of four more nurse home visitors, both in Anchorage and also in the Natsu borough now. But you're correct that 100 families, that is, there's more of a need for it outside of 100 families. There's certainly more at-risk low-income first-time moms in our state.
Thank you. And can you go back to slide 8 for a minute? That was on the outcomes identified.
Mm-hmm.
And so 79% reduction in preterm deliveries in mothers who smoked. Do we have enough of a sample to find out what the preterm delivery rate is? I know that in the last year it went up from 9.6 or so up to 10.3. So seems like overall in the state we're going in the wrong direction. So did you have is there any comparison here, or is this just looking at a very few moms who did smoke? And I'm trying to figure out how significant mm-hmm. this measurement is for us to be able to say very much about the population in the state.
Sure. So the outcomes that are listed on this slide are the outcomes that were identified in nurse-family partnership three randomized controlled trials. So this is not Alaska data. That's what they found in the original trial. Now, preterm delivery is not one of the benchmark plans, one of the indicators that we are reporting on. But it is something that we monitor in the program. I don't have a specific percentage. There have been a couple of preterm births, but again, we're dealing with small numbers. I don't know the percentage right now, but I could follow up with that and get that to you.
Okay, thank you. Maybe you can send us a link to those outcomes from the randomized controlled trials so we can look and see where those are and where Alaska compares so that we know what we're going with. I mean, last year we were proposing a 500 birth trial, protect our children now. Was using vitamin D and all, and they had taken the preterm birth down to 7% with just that initiative that was going on, and now that's being funded in South Carolina by the Select Health. The insurance company is providing because they were saving so much more by eliminating, taking that from 10.5% down to 7% preterm births would save us a lot of money and a lot of consequences. So anyway, I appreciate that if you'd forward that on back to us. Does anyone else have any other questions on this presentation? And I guess the only other thing that I would have is, you know, we're talking about folic acid usage, and I'm wondering what our neural tube defect rate is now. I know that a few years ago we established, I think we got it through legislation, that prenatal vitamins would have to have a certain amount of folic acid in them, and we were trying to get that utilized in all the communities. But maybe you can just follow up with us later, Dr. Butler, on that, because since it's one of the measures that we're talking about.
Right. And, Mr. Chairman, I believe that the following presentation will specifically address that.
Great. Thank you. Don't see any other questions, so thank you very much, Rebecca, for your presentation today, and we'll go ahead and proceed.
Right. The next presentation is by Stephanie Reitzman-Birch. Stephanie, are you there?
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, can you hear me okay? It sounds like it.
We sure can. And would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record, who you represent? And also, would you go ahead and say where you are based out of, just so we, as a committee, know where the people are based out of?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm Stephanie Reitzman-Birch. I'm the section chief for Women, Children, and Family Health in the Division of Public Health. And thank you so much for the invitation. I'm here to share with you and discuss the scientific evidence that supports the national recommendations for folic acid supplementation and what the steps were that led to this national recommendation for all women ages 15 to 44. So first, just to make sure we sort of understand what folic acid is, it's actually vitamin B that's commonly found in foods. It's also known as folate, which is actually its synthetic form. Folic acid as a synthetic form is used in vitamin supplements and is added to fortified foods such as breads, pasta, and cereal. In its natural form, folic acid is found in small amounts in spinach, broccoli, asparagus, and citrus fruits. It's an important dietary component that research has demonstrated will prevent neural tube defects. And neural tube defects are the incomplete development of the brain, the spinal cord, or its coverings that occur early in pregnancy. The research has shown it's very difficult to get an adequate amount of folic acid from diet alone, which is why pregnant women and women who may become pregnant should, or it's recommended that they take a supplement of folic acid. And you can see that the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists in 2013 and in years prior to that has made that recommendation. So a little bit of information about neural tube defects. I'm sorry, I'm on slide 3 for my slide mover. Thank you, Jill. The two most common types of neural tube defects are spina bifida and anencephaly. Spina bifida occurs when an unborn baby's spinal column does not close to protect the spinal cord. And as a result, the nerves that control leg movements and other functions do not work properly. Children with spina bifida often have lifelong disabilities and may need many surgeries as well as adaptive equipment in order to maintain their mobility and independent functioning throughout their life. Anencephaly occurs when most or all of the brain does not develop, and babies with this problem die before or shortly after birth. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention notes that about 3,000 pregnancies each year are affected by spina bifida or anencephaly. According to the Centers for Disease Control, it's estimated that 50 to 70% of neural tube defects could be prevented by taking a minimum of 0.4 milligrams of folic acid daily. The challenge, of course, is that because nearly half of all pregnancies are not planned, according to the data offered by CDC, and we have found that also to be the case in our state, the Center for Disease Control, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists recommend that all women of childbearing age, starting ages 15 through 44, should take a multivitamin with a minimum of 0.4 milligrams of folic acid. You'll notice that that's also the recommendation of the March of Dimes. Next slide, please. So how do we get to where we are right now with recommendations? This started back in 1992, where earlier recommendations were based on some of the first research done on folic acid and led by the U.S. Public Health Service, where women it was recommended that women of childbearing age consume the 0.4 milligram dose. In 1996, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, which is made up of 16 volunteer members who are nationally recognized experts in evidence-based medicine and prevention, also reviewed their studies and recommended that 0.4 milligrams should be taken by women of childbearing age on a daily basis, and this was based upon several studies. One noteworthy study was a very large randomized control trial which demonstrated statistically significant reductions in neural tube defects in women who took a multivitamin with 0.8 milligrams of folic acid. As a result of their analysis of the study and several others, they came out with a recommendation that's listed as an A recommendation. I'll explain later what that means. Of course, recognizing that not all childbearing women in particular were taking folic acid supplementation or getting adequate amounts of the natural occurring folate in their diet, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration then also mandated that folic acid be added to enrich grain products starting in 1998. And then following that recommendation, the Food and Nutrition Board of the National Academy of Sciences at the Institute of Medicine recommended that to reduce the risk for neural tube defects in affected pregnancies, women who are capable of becoming pregnant should also take the supplement of 0.4 milligrams. Next slide, please. So
just a little bit about the U.S. Preventative Task Force review, evidence review. So they conducted in 2009 a very systematic review, and based upon the evidence of benefits and harms and an assessment of the net benefit of the service by reviewing several studies. This level of meta-analysis has an important role in guiding clinical and public health practice and the education of the public at large. One study in particular that they reviewed was a randomized control trial in Hungary, which reported on the protective effects of multivitamins containing folic acid against first occurrences of neural tube defects. The study demonstrated that there were statistically significant differences between women who received the supplementation and those who did not. They also reviewed two large case control studies, one of which was done in California and one in South Carolina, looking at the association of supplementation and the outcome of neural tube defects. Both of these studies were very large study and control populations. And finally, as a meta-analysis, meaning they looked at multiple studies in this review, all of which demonstrated multivitamins with folic acid were protective for neural tube defects. I think the important part of the piece that I want to emphasize on this review of the literature is that in these studies, all of the data was non-conflicting. And so what that means is that in each of the studies, they demonstrated the same consistent results. Next slide, please. So this comprehensive review is really what the U.S. Preventative Task Force is known for. And as a result of that, they led to updating the recommendations that all women planning or capable of pregnancy take a supplement containing a minimum of 0.4 milligrams to 0.8 milligrams. As I mentioned, this was given a grade A recommendation, which means that there's a high level of certainty that the net benefit is substantial. Having this high level of certainty means the evidence is consistent and comes from multiple well-designed studies where the data does not conflict. Thus, it is unlikely the conclusions would be any different in future studies. Interestingly, there is a review of the research, again, currently happening, and according to their website, they plan to report they'll communicate their findings and report on an updated recommendation sometime in 2016. I think those of us in the provider community are anticipating that they may suggest an increase in the minimum level of folic acid. So next slide, please. So how did this then affect public health practice? Well, then back in 1999, when the early recommendations and evidence on folic acid were published, a folic acid campaign was established between the Centers for Disease Control, March of Dimes, and the National Council on Folic Acid. There were surveys that were done by CDC and March of Dimes to demonstrate where we were at, and as baseline data, it was indicated that many women were not aware of folic acid or the possibility of neural tube defects. And so this was really a public health opportunity to educate women. Just to give you an example of where we started from, the March of Dimes conducted its first survey in 1995 to establish a benchmark of knowledge and behaviors of women in childbearing age relative to daily consumption. Surveys were done for the next 6 years to measure progress. So in 1995 to 2001, here are some of the changes that occurred as a result of the national campaign. Awareness of folic acid did increase from 52% in 1995 to 79% in 2001, and the knowledge of the recommendations about supplementation more than doubled from a low of 15% to 32%. What was surprising, I think, to all of us is that this did not translate, however, into significant change in behavior in the proportion of women surveyed who stated that they were taking a multivitamin. In fact, there was an initial decrease from a high of 34% of the study population to a decrease in 29% in 2001. With the added efforts at the state, in addition to the national campaign, the percent did increase over time, however, and in 2008, which is when the last survey was conducted, about 40% of the women surveyed reported taking folic acid or a multivitamin containing folic acid, despite a reported awareness of 84% of the women. So I think this shows that despite public health education, the encouragement of healthcare providers to do something, the recommendations sometimes do not fully lead to action on the part of women and their behaviors in terms of taking folic acid supplementation. and therefore there's really an importance that supports the addition of folic acid to breads and pasta and cereal. So what happened in Alaska? So we also started in 2009. We were very fortunate to receive a small 10,000 grant from the March of Dimes. We built a coalition that included my colleagues here in the Section of Women's Children's Family Health, the Birth Defects Registry, March of Dimes, the Public Health Nurses, Municipality of Anchorage, the tribal entities, South Central Foundation, and the Women, Infant, and Children Nutrition Program. Next slide, please. Our folic acid coalition here in Alaska really maximized the use of fundings and blended and braided opportunities, and it funded development of posters and pamphlets. We did a small survey in Alaska of Alaska women to measure their knowledge and awareness, and we were able to develop materials that were going to be speak to the women here in Alaska, particularly to our tribal health partners and the women who are in our rural parts of the state. We did public service announcements, magazine ads, news spots, and we sponsored a speaker. March of Dimes generously sponsored a speaker to speak at one of the annual summer updates for OBGYN held here in Anchorage. So how has that worked? How well have we done? So nationally, since supplementation recommendations on folic acid were introduced, the prevalence of spina bifida declined 31% between 1995 and 96, in 1998 and 2006 in the U.S. This translated to a decrease, and here's where it gets a little technical, so bear with me, decrease of 5 babies per 10,000 live births down to 3.49 babies per, I'm sorry, 3.49 babies with no teeth defects per 10,000 live births in the U.S. Next slide, please. In Alaska, to answer your question, Mr. Chairman, the prevalence of neural tube defects has also decreased. And this data that I'm going to share with you, as well as some updated data that's not shown on this slide, is from our Alaska Birth Defects Registry. We actually have a statute that requires hospitals and physician offices to report on birth defects. There's a long list of them, and it's a passive surveillance system of reporting. But you can see that it's very, very important for us to help guide our practice and focus our educational efforts. There was a decrease, you can see, in the years between 2000 and 2002 from 9.7 to 5.7, and that translates to about 54 total infants were born with neural tube defects. The updated data that I have to share with you today is that between 2003 through today, so that's about 11 and a half years, there have been a total of about 90 confirmed reports of neural tube defects in Alaska. So that means on an average for each of those 11 and a half years, there are about 7 children born per year with some type of neural tube defect in Alaska. Interestingly, slightly more than 50% of these children were born with spina bifida specifically. The good news, though, is that since 2008, our numbers of neural tube defects each year has decreased, and we've been at an average of around 3.5 to 4 children per year. Next slide, please. So our current status, where are we? So this is really a standard practice in prenatal care. Our recommendation is that multivitamins, any multivitamin that is distributed for prenatal or for all women of childbearing age should include a minimum of 0.4 milligrams of folic acid. Public health continuously monitors these reports of neural tube defects, and we go out and verify as needed. We also have data from a survey that women answer after they become pregnant called the Pregnancy Risk Associated Monitoring Systems, where we really gain a tremendous amount of knowledge about pregnant women who have been pregnant, their knowledge of folic acid, the importance of birth defects prevention, and their intake of folic acid supplementation. And that's really helped us to determine new and novel ways to get this information out to women of childbearing years. Monitoring the data allows public health to determine program priorities and monitor for new evidence-based interventions and also assure that rates continue to decrease over time. As I mentioned, there are studies going on which are looking at the protectiveness of folic acid intake and the prevention of other congenital anomalies such as congenital heart and cleft lip and palate with defects. And I'm assuming that the U.S. Prevention Task Force will be reexamining the scientific evidence to determine if the recommendations should change. And as I mentioned, that they plan to be published in 2016. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm available to take any questions.
Thank you. I thought earlier you said the national recommendation was 0.8 and had been increased to that by the Preventive Task Force, and that was where they had, and we're still at 0.4?
No, the recommendation is, Mr. Chair, the recommendation is 0.4 to 0.8. That is the U.S. Preventative Task Force recommendation. So a minimum of 0.4 milligrams.
Okay, and the 3.4 per year average, are we looking at that as the 0.4 was ineffective, or is that a compliance issue that most of those did not get 0.4 per day? Do we have follow-up information on that to know whether we're talking about compliance or effectiveness?
Mr. Chair, no, we don't have information. If you remember back on page slide 3, the data that was shared by the Center for Disease Control did mention that probably only 50 to 70% of neural tube defects could be prevented from taking 0.4 milligrams of folic acid daily. So one could conclude that perhaps even if we're finding that 3 to 4 babies a year in Alaska are born with neural tube defects, it could be random genetic issues, it could be compliance, it could be availability of nutritional supplements. Medicaid, I will tell you, Medicaid covers the cost of prenatal vitamins for women who become pregnant in our state. And my review of the vitamins when I've gone to Costco to look at the many different types of vitamins that are on the shelf available just over the counter has indicated to me that most vitamins, multivitamins on a daily basis, have the minimum amounts of 0.4 milligrams already in them.
Okay, thank you. And I think it would be very worthwhile to be following up on those reported, that passive report, and finding out whether there was compliance with that or not, whether they were taking the multivitamin or whether we, you know, I mean, because if we don't know why we are getting that rate, we are unable to make a change. So I would hope that that's one of the questions on the report, is whether when a neural tube defect is reported by the doctors, they're also asking a question, you know, were prenatal vitamins taken regularly during the pregnancy. So thank you very much for the report here, and don't see any other questions.
Mr. Chairman, moving from folic acid to vitamin D, as we discussed earlier, vitamin D is a evolving and very exciting area. There are parts of the vitamin D story that I think, like folic acid, there's not any dispute. The data are not emerging. We know quite a bit. And that relates then not only to individual choice about taking supplements, what individual practitioners might do, but also how we do public health practice. So we are going to focus in this presentation on skeletal health, and I'm sure we can discuss other issues as well, as we frequently do, and I just want to acknowledge that I enjoyed that conversation and that opportunity to learn. So with us is Dr. Roz Singleton, a staff physician, recently joined the Division of Public Health, long career in the tribal health system, and I believe that she also has a pediatric endocrinologist clinician with her as well. So I'll turn it over to Dr. Singleton, and I'll let her identify herself as well as anybody else that she may have with her.
Great, thank you. Rosalyn, are you on?
Yes, I sure am. Hello, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rosalyn Singleton. I'm a staff physician with Section of Epidemiology, but I've worked with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium for 3 decades nearly. And today I will discuss 2 Alaska studies evaluating rickets and vitamin D deficiency in Alaska Native children. And with me today, since I am not an expert on vitamin D, I've invited Dr. Rachel Lesher, who is a pediatric endocrinologist, to be available to answer questions which I don't feel comfortable with. So thank you, Rachel, for joining us. Second slide. Today, the objective of the first study that I'll discuss was to understand causes of rickets and preventive measures in Alaska Native children. The second study was an exploration of the relationship between traditional marine diet and maternal vitamin D levels. And finally, I'll discuss current educational and outreach efforts. Slide number 3. Vitamin D deficiency is a nutritional deficiency with increasing prevalence since the 1990s, after being rather rare, finding for a couple centuries. And risk factors are insufficient intake or sun exposure. Sun exposure obviously is a particular issue in Alaska, and significant exclusive breastfeeding is another significant risk factor. Rickets is a state of extreme vitamin D deficiency in grown bone and occurs in infants and young children with a peak incidence between 3 and 18 months of age. It presents with wrist and rib swelling, with leg bowing, and sometimes with seizures from low calcium levels. Next slide. Vitamin D deficiency is defined by the American Academy of Pediatrics, or the AAP, and also by the Institute of Medicine, the Pediatric Endocrine Society, and the European Society for Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, and the Endocrine Society, as a level of 25 hydroxy vitamin D below 20 nanograms per ml. And this is associated with a level of higher risk for skeletal effects. In addition, the Endocrine Society also defines vitamin D insufficiency as 21 to 29 nanograms per ml, a level at which individuals may be at increased risk for extraskeletal effects, which are not as clearly understood. Next slide. All of these groups state that evidence is insufficient to recommend universal screening for vitamin D deficiency. Specifically, the American Academy of Pediatric advises screening for vitamin D deficiency only in children and adolescents with conditions associated with reduced bone mass and or recurrent fractures, for instance, malabsorption and liver disease. The Endocrine Society also recommends screening of at-risk individuals, including children with obesity, black and Hispanic children. But this is somewhat controversial, and according to the AAP, it would involve screening, testing, retesting large numbers of children without evidence of clear cost benefit in reducing fractures. Well, what about food, since we don't have much sunlight? Salmon and other oily fish have some of the highest vitamin D contents of any food. And I'll point you to sockeye salmon. Canned sockeye salmon has over 700 international units of vitamin D. In the past, we'll show that Alaska Native people with a high marine subsistence diet had high intake of vitamin D and also high levels of vitamin D. Well, what about supplementation recommendations? The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that any breastfed or partially breastfed infant be supplemented with 400 international units of vitamin D. Non-breastfed infants who take less than 1 liter per day of vitamin D fortified formula or milk should be supplemented with 400 international units also. the amount of vitamin D in 1 liter of infant formula is around 400 international units. And then older children and adolescents are recommended to have supplementation with 600 international units of vitamin D if dietary intake is inadequate. So onto our studies. This in my first 15 years of pediatric practice, I didn't see a case of rickets. However, in 1996, I diagnosed a healthy breastfeeding infant with rickets, and that got my attention. In 2010, I was approached by an Alaska Native Medical Center physician who was concerned about the number of rickets, cases of rickets he was seeing in northern communities. A group of tribal and CDC physicians and epidemiologists donated their time to study this issue, and we evaluated the incidence of rickets hospitalizations and outpatient visits, and we also did a case control study comparing children with vitamin D deficiency and confirmed rickets with age and region matched children to look at factors associated with rickets. Well, one of the first and interesting findings that we found was even in our population, among the 16 confirmed cases of rickets, the incidence actually increased by latitude, even in that small cohort. Mm-hmm. And you can see how there was a significant increase from the lower latitude in Alaska to Barrow being the highest. The overall study results show that rickets inpatient and outpatient visit rates were higher in Alaska Native children than in the general U.S. population and in other Indian Health Service sites based on large database studies. We found that in addition to increased latitude, rickets diagnosis was increased when there was a diagnosis of malnutrition. Rickets and vitamin D deficiency occurred, interestingly, in both breastfed and formula-fed infants. But rickets and vitamin D deficiency were more common in infants who did not receive vitamin D supplementation. And this confirmed the importance of the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendation for vitamin D supplementation. So we were interested in the potential connection between apparent increases in rickets and the known decline in marine subsistence diet among Alaskan Native people. And whereas before the 1960s, a significant proportion of energy was derived from the marine subsistence diet, in more recent food intake surveys, only about 6% of energy came from marine subsistence foods in younger people. In an interim study that was about in the 1990s, early 2000s, about 21% of energy came from native foods, and 82% of the vitamin D came from those subsistence foods. So to do this, we collaborated with the Yukon Customer Health Corporation and investigators from the Center for Alaska Native Health Research, University of Fairbanks, and University of Washington to explore how the intake of traditional foods and serum vitamin D levels have changed in childbearing women. And we tested de-identified samples from the Alaska Area Specimen Bank in childbearing age women 20 to 29 years of age at points from the 1960s to the 1990s for biomarkers of a traditional marine diet called a Delta-15N and the 25-hydroxy vitamin D levels. So let's talk a little bit more about this Delta-15N. Well, it turns out Dr. Diane O'Brien has shown that fish and marine mammals are naturally enriched in the heavy stable isotope of nitrogen. And as fish and marine mammal intake increases, so does the isotope ratio in blood and hair. And they're very consistent. A person with no marine diet intake would be expected to have a delta 15N of about 8 per mil. And each increase of one per mil, which is a unit of relative enrichment, corresponds with an increase in traditional food intake of about 7% of the total energy. So let's look at the results. We found a significant decline in both vitamin D levels from sufficient levels with a mean over 40 nanograms per ml in the 1960s on the left in the orange to the mid-20s in the 1990s. To put it in further context, in the 1960s, 100% of the women tested had vitamin D levels greater than 20 nanograms per ml, and half had levels greater than 50 nanograms per ml. In contrast, by the 1990s, only 72% had levels greater than 20 nanograms per ml, and 0% had levels greater than 50 nanograms per ml. Similarly, the delta 15N in red decreased from a mean of 13, which is similar to levels found in elders, to just over 10, which is relatively low marine diet intake. In the next slide, in this scattergram, it turns out the vitamin D levels and delta 15N levels were very highly correlated with a p-value of less than 0.001. In summary, on the next slide, we found that vitamin D levels correlated very highly with intake of traditional marine foods, and both declined significantly between the 1960s and the 1990s. And this correlates with food intake surveys. Marine intake by childbearing women was very high in the 1960s. It was similar to what's in current UPIC elders, but it's dropped to low levels. Importantly, this decreased marine intake was associated with low vitamin D levels in childbearing age women. And in pregnant women, this could put their infants at risk for rickets early in life, and it could help to explain the apparent increase that we've seen in rickets in this population starting in the 1990s. So what has the Division of Public Health done to disseminate these findings? In 2014, we did a state epi bulletin on rickets and vitamin D deficiency in children. We highlighted the infant vitamin D supplementation guidelines, and we followed that up with Grand Rounds presentations in both Anchorage and Bethel. Last week, we had a publication of a peer-reviewed journal article showing the results of the first study in the Journal of Pediatric Endocrine and Metabolism. Dr. Rachel Lesher presented at the Alaska Native Research Conference, and next week she'll be presenting at the International Meeting on Indigenous Child Health. So what else are we doing to outreach to communities? We've contacted public relations officials and at ANTHC and at YKHC and other tribal organizations who are helping us start to design and get out the message of the nutritional benefit of salmon and other traditional foods and the importance of recommended vitamin D supplementation for infants and for pregnant women who have inadequate diets. And ANTHC's Store Outside Your Door is working on engaging communities to increase subsistence diet. And in a couple weeks, I'll be presenting in Bethel at the tribal gathering to the elders in the YK Delta. And thank you very much. I would love to answer any questions.
Well, thank you very much. Really appreciate that. And would you mind sending us a link or sending us the articles, both the initial study as well as the pediatric and endocrine metabolism article? Appreciate that. One thing as you go forward, I know we're looking at traditional diets, and I think that that's very you know, appropriate. However, one thing that we've run into is even your slides here show a modern traditional diet, which is the salmon is hung under plywood or under tarps. And what is being lost is the traditional food preparation technique of sun drying. And when you sun dry, sun exposure to UVB to oil is the way you create vitamin D vitamin D supplements. So ultraviolet B is very important, and that's when you're drying salmon. But if you're not drying them out in the sunshine, like the elders used to do, or if you're refrigerating them or putting them in a freezer and they don't get any sun exposure, there could be a tremendous difference in the amount of vitamin D in those strips just because of the food preservation technique that was used for 10,000 years. So I hope that as we go forward, we'll look at that, because whether it's reindeer or whether it's, you know, in Russia, or whether it's caribou or meats, which have oils in them if they're sun-dried for the preservation technique, which was the traditional preservation technique, it tremendously increases the vitamin D level that's in the food. And so I think we don't want to forget not only what the food is, but how the food is prepared and kept. We are now going to, sorry we've run out of time here, we'll want to get back to everyone on these topics again in the future, but we have the kids facing foster care, facing foster care, and if Amanda would come forward, and unfortunately I have another meeting, so I'm turning the gavel over to Vice Chair Vasquez, and we will be about 10 minutes, and then we'll have to get on to HB 40, and obviously we're probably not going to have time to finish that testimony, and so we'll leave the testimony on HB 40 open as well. Mm-hmm. And appreciate you taking over. Thank you, and sorry I can't be here. I'll catch up on the video on the presentation.
Great, thanks.
Welcome.
You ready?
Yes.
For the record, my name is Amanda Mativier, and I'm the executive director of Facing Foster Care in Alaska. We're a statewide nonprofit of young people in and from the foster care system. I spent 3 years in our foster care system myself. I aged out of the system. I went on to be a foster parent, and I have 2 degrees in social work from UAA. I'm also actually a constituent of Representative Vasquez. So I'll be brief. I wanted to talk today about House Bill 27 related to foster care, and I had spoke with Representative Seaton before this, and he gave me permission to do this. It's going to kind of reflect weird on the record, but we have an event happening right now. So we have about 22 foster youth right now from around the state that are here in Juneau, and they're meeting with various offices to talk about some of the things that are important to them, some of the things that concern them, because really we're the ones who live and breathe the system every single day. And so we believe that we're the experts. And so all of our youth are in the back of the room. So if our youth could just stand if you've been in foster care. If you could remain standing if you have been in foster care for more than 2 years. Remain standing if you've been in foster care for more than 4. More than 6 years. 8 years. 10 years. 12 years, 15 years, 16 years, 17, 18, 19. Stand up if you've had more than one foster care placement. Remain standing if you've had more than 2, 5, 10, 15, 20. 22, 24, 26, 30, 32, 35, 40, 45, 50, 55, 60. Stand up if moving between foster care placements, you move schools. Stay standing if you've moved schools more than twice. More than four? Six? Eight? 10? 15? Stand up if you were placed separately from your siblings. Have a seat. Stand up if you've experienced homelessness while in foster care. Have a seat. Stand up if you ever felt that you've been judged because of your status in foster care. Have a seat. So I really appreciate you giving us the opportunity to come today. I know we only have a few minutes. And I know I listened to the hearing on House Bill 27. I wasn't able. I was going to call in, and I actually was sick in the hospital. But I just wanted to say that there's a few things in this bill that are really important to us that we asked for. And I know that what I heard, it was OCS said that they do all these things. But some of the things that are really important to us are ensuring that youth are ready to be released from care if they're 18 or over. I know that they said that they hold a hearing or make sure that youth are ready. We have youth here today who are being asked to leave the system or who have been released without notice, who didn't have a high school diploma, GED, housing, were absolutely unprepared and have spent nearly their entire lives in foster care, have moved schools, have moved multiple change in home placements. Also reducing the time to finding permanency. The federal standard says that we're supposed to work within 12 to 24 months to ensure that youth either go home or are placed in adoptive placement, guardianship, relative care, that they move quickly out of our system. And we're spending a lot more money by leaving young people in care for 15 years, but we should also be working to find a permanent family because we do more damage by keeping them in our system. They fall behind in school. They struggle as adults with housing, homelessness, higher education. It also requires foster parent recruitment. The number of children in our state system is going up right now. It's at 2,400. It's a record high, and it's increasing. The state continues to take custody of more youth. We don't have enough workers or time for workers to be able to get out and actually even see children in their homes. And finally, it also supports some information sharing with tribes early on so that if a case is screened out, they can let the tribe know if it is if a family that is a member of that tribe. So they can ideally intervene and provide support and intervention early on so we can avoid young people coming into our system. We all believe that as young people in the system, the state is our parent. And so, again, I appreciate you allowing time today for me to come and speak and for our youth to show you that.
Well, thank you. Any questions? No questions. Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you for the youth that have appeared today before us. It was very impressive. Thank you.
Yes.
We're next going to be taking HB 40, e-cigarettes. Welcome, Representative Herron. Please come forward. And address us.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Bob Herron, representative from Health thank District 38.
Welcome.
So, Madam Chair, I'd just like to make a real short statement. My staff, Rob, is here, and more importantly, there's others here that wish to testify. The reason I introduced this legislation is I appreciate the fact that there are products that people can buy, like e-cigarettes, and it's their right, and I have no problem with the device at all. The issue, though, is there might not be any smoke, there might not be any ash, but the issue with me is how does a person dispose of the exhaled aerosol safely, and it doesn't harm others. So that's why I would like to see the use of these devices be taken to a place where people are allowed to smoke, and that's why the moving into the definition. And I'm available for questions, but others would like to testify.
Yes. Any questions of Representative Herron? Seeing no questions, we'll proceed with additional witnesses that wish to testify. I have here Misty Jensen. Is she available?
Yes,
Ms. Jensen?
Yes, I'm here.
Well,
thank you. I'm in Wasilla.
Yes. And tell us of any affiliation you have.
Okay, my name is Misty Michelle Jensen. My last name is J-E-N-S-E-N.
Any affiliation, Ms. Jensen?
Nope, I'm just speaking as a constituent.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you. I want to testify in favor of HB 40 and the importance of treating electronic cigarettes the same as traditional cigarettes with regard to secondhand smoke. The vapor from an e-cigarette is not water vapor, but is in fact an aerosol that contains nicotine and toxic chemicals, and that is from the CDC. It's not safe to smoke or inhale. As a mother of two daughters, aged 11 and 14, I'm horrified by the messages that they see in ads and in stores promoting e-cigarettes as safe. This simply is not true. We are in danger of the renormalization of smoking with the emergence of these new products. And as leaders and decision makers in healthcare, we must send a clear message that smoking includes the use of electronic cigarettes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions of this witness? Thank you. We'll go on to our next witness. We do have someone in the audience, Ms. Emily Ninon. Can you come up and, for the record, tell us your name, spell your surname, and your affiliation, if any. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be before you. For the record, my name is Emily Ninon. My last name is spelled N-E-N-O-N. I am the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, and pleased to be here before you again today on this topic of electronic cigarettes. I have submitted a letter that you should have in your packets. Also did respond to the committee aide with some information that Representative Stutz had asked some questions for some more information when I was here on Tuesday. So those citations are there, and I'm just want to mention there are hundreds of different products on the market being marketed as electronic cigarettes, and they are unregulated, which means we don't know what's in any given one of them. I'm not here to talk about their use as a cessation device. This bill doesn't address that. We're strictly looking at exposure to the secondhand aerosol. As the previous testifier mentioned, the difference between a vapor as a state of matter versus an aerosol contains fine particles, unlike a vapor, of either liquid, solid, or both. There are a number of growing number of studies that have looked at the contents of e-cigarette aerosol. Propylene glycol, nicotine, and flavorings were most commonly found in that e-cigarette aerosol, and other studies have found the aerosol to contain heavy metals, volatile organic compounds, tobacco-specific nitrosamines, and other potentially harmful chemicals, which is why we're concerned about secondhand exposure. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any further questions the committee may have and continue to carry on this conversation through the process.
Yes, Representative Stute.
Thank you. I'm looking at my information here, and I have lots of information from people that say they don't support House Bill 40, but I don't see any of the studies or any of that information that you're speaking of. Now, maybe since we're going to leave this open, you could drop it by my office, but I'm interested in actually seeing the studies, seeing how current they are, and seeing how firm they are, because everything that I've been able to find myself and read, it's maybe, possibly, could be, and it appears that there's just not enough information to classify these as a tobacco type cigarette. Mm-hmm. I read several articles. The most recent is March 12th, 2015. New study finds no health concerns in e-cigarette vapors. So, you know, this is clearly a pretty controversial issue, and I certainly wouldn't expect you to take any other position than you've taken, being that you work for the American Cancer Society. But I still, and again, I say maybe there's evidence that I haven't seen, but I'm just not convinced that this is, that there's enough evidence to say, and without seeing the actual studies and who they're by and how current they are, and that they're actually solid, I'm having a hard time with this.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions of this witness?
If I may, I do have the documents that I emailed to the committee aide earlier. I have those in my hand here.
Okay.
Be happy to give those to you and carry on this. Be happy to continue the conversation and compare notes with what we're all learning here about these new products. Thank you.
Oh, I have.
And was that distributed to everyone?
Here, I'll give it to.
And we can make sure copies are made for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Appreciate it. And the next witness is also present in the room. Dr. Butler, would you step up? And
thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Jay Butler. What am I? I'm the Chief Medical Officer in the Department of Health and Social Services. It may well be that aerosols from e-cigarettes pose less of a threat from secondhand exposure than traditional cigarettes, but I would caution against assuming that they are safe, given that studies have shown that metabolites of nicotine are recoverable from people who are exposed to aerosols from e-cigarettes secondhand. The division has struggled also with this question of where do e-cigarettes fall on the spectrum of risk, and recently completed a literature review. So I'll be happy to get a copy of that to the entire committee so that you would have that for reference as well.
Thank you, Dr. Butler.
You know, there is potential for e-cigarettes as a harm reduction technique, perhaps even for smoking cessation tool. But I think it's important to keep in mind that some of the data suggests that actually e-cigarettes are being used as a way to deliver supplemental nicotine to people who currently smoke rather than as replacement for smoking. And in fact, when you look at some of the way the product is marketed, the majority are talking about ways that you can smoke when smoking's not allowed. I also wanted to raise the concern about the fact that we've made a lot of progress in smoking reduction among our young people, yet the way e-cigarettes are being marketed with flavors like Cherry Crush, Peachy Keen, Skittles, Bubble Gum, Captain Crunch, Chocolate Treat, Vanilla Dreams, these are seem to be going for a much younger demographic than the Marlboro Man is going to appeal to. So I think as we struggle with this question of what are the threats, there's two that I wanted to highlight. One has already been highlighted by one of the constituents who called in, and that is that e-cigarettes pose the threat of renormalizing smoking behavior, and I think that's particularly a challenge for our younger people. Also, given what we do know is in the aerosols, as well as what we don't know, because it's not a regulated product, it's considered proprietary information, I think it does pose a threat to indoor air quality. Therefore, the goals of HB 40 to allow e-cigarette use only in places where cigarette smoking is not prohibited makes good public health sense. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Dr. Butler?
No questions.
Thank you. And we look forward to the written materials you refer to. Thank you.
Good question.
The next witness is on the line, Ashley Pertier.
Hello, I'm here.
Yes, thank you. For the record, please identify yourself and the affiliation of any.
Okay. My name is Ashley Peltier. My last name is spelled P-E-L-T-I-E-R, and I'm here today representing myself. I live in Bolton, West Villa. I'm here today in support of HB 40 to ask you to treat electronic cigarettes the same as traditional cigarettes in regard to secondhand smoke exposure. The vapor emitted by these devices has been shown to contain ultrafine particles that, when inhaled, exacerbate respiratory issues such as asthma. The vapor is also known to contain chemicals such as benzene, cadmium, and formaldehyde. Additionally, as Dr. Butler mentioned, flavored vape juices such as cotton candy and gummy bear are particularly enticing to youth, which is concerning to me. I'd also like to state that there was a time when the tobacco industry told us that secondhand smoke was harmless, and not only that it was harmless, but that smoking was good for us. We now know different, and I am reluctant to trust the tobacco industry when they say that e-cigarettes and secondhand aerosol are safe. Nobody should be unwillingly exposed to a substance that can harm them, and I ask you to support HB 40 because everyone deserves the right to breathe clean air. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions of this witness? Seeing none, we'll thank you very much. We'll proceed to our next witness, Mr. Clay Bezanek. Mr. Bezanek?
Yeah, do you hear me?
Yes, clearly.
Yeah, hello there.
Hi.
My name's Clay Bezanek. My name is, last name is B-E-Z-E-N-E-K.
Any affiliation?
No, just myself as a citizen of the state.
Welcome. You may proceed.
Thank you very much. I learned a lot of stuff today about a lot of things other than this, so it was a good time sitting on the phone hanging out. I'm definitely against House Bill 40. I really understand the reasoning behind it for sure. I think that possibly some federal legislation should be in the works to regulate the industry. However, I commercial fish for salmon here in Southeast, and the rest of the year I work on tugboats, and I know firsthand numerous people that have quit smoking because of e-cigarettes, and being a non-smoker myself, I've actually got on different tugboats because the whole crew smoked except me, and it was so annoying to have to smell smoke in a tight, confined space such as a tugboat, even though it's 100 feet long. It was just, you know, stupid. I grew up in a smoking family, so I'm pretty anti-smoking, actually, and I've seen the e-cigarette industry come out. I think it's a real positive step for the tobacco industry to do what they're doing, but I think the regulation is a little premature on vilifying people, as it were, to make them step outside or go in another part of a facility when I haven't seen the information. And believe me, if I'm going to smoke or if I'm going to smell secondhand smoke, even from an e-cigarette, I've done a lot of research myself, and until I find out that it's a bad thing for me, then I'll definitely be against it. But I just think that House Bill 40 is just a little bit possibly before its time. So I thank you for the ability to testify.
Thank you for patiently waiting. I see you've waited almost 2 hours to testify, so thank
no
you.
No problem.
Any questions of this witness? Well, thank you. This will be, unfortunately, our last witness. We have to go to the floor to consider the budget. I realize there's 14 or 15 other individuals that would like to testify. We will keep public testimony open. We will hold HB 40 over for more discussions at a later date and for more witnesses to speak on the issue, and we'll have to adjourn. I'm sorry. Anyway.